made a very strong, persuasive, and credible argument told a story that was very compelling in terms of what happened to her vis-a-vis Clarence Thomas. You know, we believed her, and, you know, I think, you know, we've been borne out. But the other thing I want to say is that, you know, in this atmosphere of Donald Trump, I think that's another significant change. When you have someone who is an admitted sexual predator in the White House, the Republican senators can tolerate Trump. They certainly are prepared to defend and tolerate the kinds of actions that Brett Kavanaugh
has alleged. Well, this is part one of our discussion. Barbara Ransby has a new book out. It's called Making All Black Lives Matter. Barbara Ransby is a professor of women's studies and history at University of Illinois, Chicago. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining.
Warning, the following message is only for listeners who contributed during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. If you did not contribute to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, please turn off your radio now.
On behalf of the entire KBOO community, we'd like to offer our deepest and sincerest thanks for your contribution to KBOO's Fall Membership Drive. Your support makes KBOO possible. Thank you.
If you didn't contribute during KBOO's Fall Membership Drive, you may now turn your radio back on.
It's not too late. Go to kboo.fm/give to make a contribution right now.
Then the next time this spot plays, you'll be able to listen.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Here and There, audio postcards from Earth on Tuesday, October 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. at OMSI in Portland.
Here and There, audio postcards from Earth is an all-ages and ability-inclusive event featuring nature sounds and field recordings in immersive surround sound from scientists and artists local and abroad from some of the world's most remote locations.
Listen to these places while sitting under the shifting stars from that time and place in nature's memory. Again, that's Here and There, audio postcards from Earth on Tuesday, October 9th from 7 to 9 p.m. at OMSI, 1945 Southeast Water Avenue, Portland.
More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today the Beaverton Police Department released the name of the man injured in a police shooting on September 7th.
A second woman accused Brett Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct during his Supreme Court confirmation hearing.
And an Indonesian teen was rescued after drifting at sea on a floating fish trap for 49 days.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 24th, 2018. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Summer Barraza. TriMet's practice of irritability, stopping MAX passengers, and asking for proof of fare has been ruled unconstitutional. In an opinion released Friday afternoon, Judge John Whitmayer wrote that a TriMet fare inspector and a transit officer illegally stopped and detained MAX passenger Anna Del Rocio in March after asking for her MAX ticket. Del Rocio is a school board member in the David Douglas School District. She was detained and taken to jail by transit police because of a discrepancy about her name on her ID, which had been changed following an abusive situation. Since the fare officer said he couldn't confirm her identity, he charged Del Rocio with giving a police officer false information. Local groups have documented the racial disparity in fare enforcement by TriMet officers as their tendency to carry out fare inspection sting operations in poorer neighborhoods. In a statement to the ACLU, Del Rocio wrote that, quote, "Being wrongfully arrested, jailed, and prosecuted nearly broke her. No person should ever be made to feel confused or afraid by officers that are supposed to be keeping us safe. Our task now, long overdue, is to figure out a better, more humane, and dignified way to treat our transit riders."
Today, the Beaverton Police Department released the name of the man injured in a police shooting on September 7th. 22-year-old Anthony Shaner was shot and wounded by Beaverton Police Officer Dan Coulson, who's a 22-year veteran on the force. On the morning of the 7th, according to the police, officers responded to a report of a man riding a bike while carrying a large knife. News reports indicate the incident involved Shaner allegedly threatening a 7-Eleven employee with a knife before officers found him, whereupon he went into a nearby bottle drop, gestured at the officers with the knife, then left through a side door and was shot outside the bottle drop. The police have released very few details of the shooting, and even in today's release, they only say the interaction, quote, "ultimately ended in an officer-involved shooting," unquote. The Washington County DA presented the case to a grand jury today, which returned an indictment on Shaner for 3 counts of unlawful use of a weapon. 2 Beaverton officers and a store owner were listed as victims, though no assault or interference charges were returned, so it remains unclear what exactly prompted Coulson to shoot. Shaner will be arrested when he's released from the hospital. Coulson remains on paid administrative leave. It's unknown if the DA will present a case against him to a grand jury, but given today's indictments, it does not appear likely.
2018 has seen more police shootings in Oregon than any year since at least 2010, with 30 known incidents as of Thursday, September 20th. That puts us past the 29th shooting incident recording by Portland Cop Watch in 2013. A Cop Watch and the Scanner newspaper have reported statewide data on police shootings have only been mandated since 2018, though this has not been fully implemented and the most complete tracking is still being done by citizen observers. The fatal shooting of Matthew Graves in Eagle Point on Thursday was the 30th incident that KABU has counted this year. Those 30 events involved 31 civilians and caused 15 deaths, including one suicide. 24 different law enforcement agencies were involved, including the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, Portland State University Campus Police, and local agencies ranging from the Portland Police Bureau to the 6-officer Almsville Police Department. The incidents had occurred in 12 Oregon counties, with 6 in Multnomah, 5 in Washington, 4 each in Marion and Lane counties, and 3 in Jackson County.
As reported by Ronan Farrow and Jane Mayer of The New Yorker, a second woman has accused Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct. Deborah Ramirez, Kavanaugh's classmate at Yale University, claimed that Kavanaugh stuck his penis in her face at a party. This allegation looms over Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearing as Republicans try to accelerate the nomination process. Attorney Michael Avenatti announced that a third accuser reached out to him and will go public by Wednesday. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, the first woman to accuse Kavanaugh of sexual misconduct, is scheduled to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Thursday.
A rally in March was hosted today at Portland State University. This outcry comes after Jason Washington, a black man, was gunned down by PSU police officers James Dewey and Sean McKenzie in late June. The mission of the event was to bring justice to Washington by disarming campus security and firing the officers responsible. KABU reporter Jenka Soderberg was at the rally and obtained footage of the event.
Disarm PSU!
Disarm PSU!
Disarm PSU!
Disarm PSU!
Disarm PSU!
Disarm PSU!
We have a guest speaker. The family has asked to speak. Her name is Joanne Hardesty, and she's going to come up right now.
How wonderful to see so many people standing up for what is right, for what is fair, for what is just. Let there be no mistake, Jason is dead today because he was a black man picking up a weapon when police showed up. Do you think if he had been any other color, the police would have at least stopped to ask a question or two. It is not okay that black lives are being extinguished without outrage. We live in a city with a 6% black population, yet 54% of Portland's gang enforcement unit stops are of African Americans. Do the math. That makes no sense. Where is the outrage when our children are being targeted, arrested, prosecuted by all the government entities that are supposed to keep them safe? Today, TriMet has a $7.3 million contract with a private security firm to harass and target people who don't have $2.50. That is how incidents like Jason Washington happens. It happens because there's not enough outrage of this daily targeting of people with no power, no position, no opportunity. That's how we create these situations. How can people continue to die, yet no one did anything wrong? How did you shoot a man six times? Nine times. Because you know when you're shooting black people, you got to shoot them over and over and over again, because we're like, we got that superpower, right? I want to understand why there's not more outrage. I thank each and every one of you for showing up today, because it will take each and every one of us to over and over and over again say, no, not in my name. No, this is not acceptable. Not in my city. Not on my watch. This is not the way that you build a beloved community. It is absolutely true that Portland State University had the opportunity to listen to their students. They had the opportunity to listen to their faculty. They had the opportunity to listen to their community partners. And everybody said no. No weapons, no guns, not on campus. Weapons and students don't mix. We all said that. The only people that wanted to arm police on Portland State University campus was the Board of Trustees. That was the only people. The blood is on the hands of Portland State University Board of Trustees. They must stand up and be held accountable. They must. My heart absolutely breaks for this family and for every other family in Portland who has not received justice, because law enforcement acted quickly and killed people because they had a mental health issue or because they just ran up and just saw a black man picking up a gun and just decided he's got to be the criminal. This is not okay. We deserve better, and we can do better. It is our job. It is our job to hold this campus accountable. It is our job to hold this city accountable. It is our job to make sure that our leaders represent us. Right? We have that opportunity. So, I want to make sure that you understand that unless we disarm Portland State University police, this will be a recurring event. Do not be misled. This wasn't a one-off, because there are way too many community members. Keith Notice, Kendra James, Erin Campbell, I could go on and on. I have cried with too many parents and too many siblings who've lost their loved ones. We must make this stop. No more, not in our name. We will not criminalize people for being homeless. It is a failure of our government, not a failure of the 4,000 people sleeping on the street. It is a failure of our government to provide affordable housing for everyone. We can do better. We must do better. No more. No more. No more. No more. Say his name.
Jason Washington.
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 That was Jenka Soderberg at the Disarm PSU rally.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. San Francisco has removed a statue Native Americans say is derogatory. The move comes as nearby Stanford University says it will rename some of its landmarks named after a missionary. Christina Onnested reports.
The name Pioneer Statue says it all. A cowboy and a missionary stand tall with a Native American man kneeling at their feet. Indigenous rights activists say it subjugates Native Americans, and San Francisco city officials agree. Video on social media shows the large bronze statue being removed in the dead of night. Native American activist Barbara Mumbi Huerta has been trying to remove the pioneer statue near San Francisco City Hall for more than 20 years. She says it's about time they stop depicting monsters as heroes.
They're perpetuators of genocide. They're people who have supported Holocaust, and they're no different, if not worse, than Hitler. And we've been brainwashed to think that there are heroes, but they're not. So, you know, that's a narrative that is starting to shift.
San Francisco's decision to remove its pioneer statue comes as Palo Alto's Stanford University announced it will rename its mall. It was named after Junipero Serra, who founded California's mission system that forced indigenous communities into slavery and instituted religious persecution. And officials at California State University Long Beach say they are no longer using a settler-era mascot, Prospector Pete. They say it's racially insensitive. Christina Onnested, National Native News, California.
Oglala Lakota artist Kevin Puyer took a top prize at the Santa Fe Indian Market in New Mexico this year. He entered a belt depicting 8 contemporary Native women involved in arts and activism. The artist carved sections of the bell out of buffalo horn and inlaid it with other material. Victoria Wicks has more.
Kevin Puyer says a lot of Native artists create traditional art because that's what sells. Puyer says he also makes jewelry and other decorative items, but he prefers to turn his focus to the immediate concerns of his community and tribe.
Those old images of the hunting and the battle scenes, those are our ancestor stories that they did, and I got my story to tell in 2018. We have a lot to talk about, so that's what we focus on, is what's going on today.
That's why he chose to depict still-living Native women who are artists and activists addressing climate change and other environmental issues, preservation of indigenous language and traditions, and human and civil rights. Puyer credits his wife and arts business partner with inspiring the piece. Valerie Morgan says with the Me Too movement and the participation of women at Standing Rock, this belt's time had come.
Last year's belt was a series of images about Standing Rock, but we wanted to move forward from that because it's happened, and I said we need to do some women.
The belt has been purchased by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian in Washington, D.C. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
The Associated Press reports some Navajo people who alleged sexual abuse as children in a former Mormon church foster program have filed to dismiss their cases after reaching settlements. More than a dozen allegations against the church were made by Navajo and Crow tribal members. Some cases were recently settled, others last year, and one remains open, according to the AP. The alleged abuse took place in the 1960s and 80s during a program which put Native children in foster homes in Utah, Idaho, and New Mexico. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with the Portland Psychedelic Society. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, a low of 49 degrees and a high of 83 tomorrow with a sunny sky. And in Hood River, a clear sky of 46 and a high of 80 tomorrow. Clear skies tonight with a low of 51 and a high of 65 degrees. 5% chance of rain and around 7 to 10 miles per hour winds. Today in history, in 1964, the Warren Commission released its report to the President Lyndon Johnson, concluding that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in the assassination of John F. Kennedy. The report was made public 3 days later. The quote of the day is from John F. Kennedy. Conformity is the jailer of freedom and the enemy of growth.
A group of scientists wondered what MDMA, versions of which are known as Molly or ecstasy, would do to other species. They decided to do the experiment on octopi. Octopi are intelligent, but Gizmodo said humans and octopi have been heading along different branches of the evolutionary tree for 500 million years. Rather than one localized brain with a cortex, the octopus's decentralized nervous system includes control centers from each arm in addition to a brain. Gull Dolan and her colleague Eric Etzinger wondered whether the chemistry behind human social behaviors, the system controlling the serotonin molecule, also existed in the solitary asocial octopus. By analyzing the octopus genome, they found octopi have genes that seem to code for serotonin transporters, proteins responsible for moving serotonin molecules into brain cells. Serotonin is the molecule generally considered to be responsible for feeling good. When humans take MDMA, it binds to serotonin transporter proteins that change the way serotonin travels between brain cells, like producing the warm and fuzzy high the drug is known for. Dolan, an assistant professor of neuroscience at Johns Hopkins University, told Gizmodo that, quote, an octopus doesn't have a cortex and doesn't have a rewind circuit, and yet it's able to respond to MDMA and produce the same effects in an animal with totally different brain organization. Dolan added, people are beginning to recognize that these drugs are powerful tools for understanding how the brain evolved. They're such strong activators of these behaviors, it's not subtle.
Cody Wilson, the owner of a Texas company that's making untraceable 3D guns, was back in the U.S. Sunday after being arrested in Taiwan. Police say he flew there after learning he was being investigated for allegedly having sex with an underage girl. The U.S. Marshals Service said 30-year-old Cody Wilson was booked into Harris County Jail in Houston early Sunday and was being held on a $150,000 bond. Authorities say Wilson met the girl through the website SugarDaddyMeat.com, according to an affidavit. The girl said they met in the parking lot of an Austin coffee shop and then drove to a hotel. The girl told investigators Wilson paid her $500 after they had sex and then dropped her off at a Whataburger restaurant. The New York Times writes that Wilson is the owner of the Austin-based Defense Distributed. 19 states and the District of Columbia have sued the Trump administration to dissolve a settlement it reached with the company over allowing it to decimate its designs for making a 3D printable gun. The New York Times said law enforcement officials worry the guns are easy to conceal and are untraceable since there's no requirement for the firearms to have serial numbers. Gun industry experts have said the guns are a modern method of legally assembling a gun from home with no serial numbers.
The United Nations has accidentally published passwords, internal documents, and technical details about websites. The mistake occurred when employees misconfigured popular project management service Trello, issue tracking app Jira, and Office Suite Google Docs. This made sensitive material available online to anyone with a proper link, rather than only to specific users who should have access. Security researcher Kushagra Patak discovered the accidental leak and notified the UN about what he found a little over a month ago. As of today, much of the material appears to have been taken down. People often make their organization's sensitive data public simply because it's more convenient. Patak has been something of a specialist in finding private information on public Trello boards. Earlier this year, he discovered a range of private data, including passwords and security plans, belonging to the governments of the UK and Canada on 50 unprotected boards. Before that, he uncovered a large swath of sensitive data on Trello belonging to dozens of other organizations, including a well-known ride-sharing company.
An Indonesian teen was rescued after drifting at sea on a floating fish trap for 49 days. 19-year-old Aldi Novel Adiling was working as a lamp keeper on a type of fishing trap known as a rampong. Rampongs are traps that sit on buoys or floats and are anchored to concrete blocks on the sea floor. Adeling's job was to light lamps on the trap each night to attract fish. He was hired for 6 months and someone would come each week to drop off food, water, and supplies and harvest the fish. He was located off the northern coast of Manado of the North Sulawesi province. In mid-July, strong winds and ocean currents broke the rope, tethering the trap to the sea floor. Adeling was then drifted out into open sea on the rampong. He was found on August 31st in the waters of Guam by a Panamanian ship, the MV Apregio. Officials say Adelang was more than 10 ships during his time at sea, but none spotted him in the water. He is now home safe and has been reunited with his family.
Now it's time for the Middle East Minute Plus. On today's episode, tensions heat up between Russia and Israel.
This is the Middle East Minute Plus, and I am Salim Shahadeh. Russia has accused Israel of, quote, premeditated actions over the downing of a Russian plane in Syria last week, warning it will harm relations between the two countries. Following the remarks, Russia's defense minister announced that Russia will be sending an advanced air defense system to the Syrian military, as well as jamming communications of any military planes that attack Syria from over the Mediterranean. On September 17, Israeli F-16 planes were attacking Syrian territories. In response, Syria's outdated air defense missile system attempted to shoot down the Israeli plane, but its pilot used a larger Russian plane in the area as cover, and the Russian plane was shot down in the confusion. The Russian upgrade to the Syrian air defense missile system is a reversal of previous agreements with Israel. The new S-300 system was a deal that Russia had signed with Syria in 2013, but Israel pressured Russia to hold off delivering these units. In the aftermath of Israel's actions to down a Russian plane, Russia has decided to go against its agreement with Israel. Russia has been militarily engaged in Syria since 2015 to support President Bashar al-Assad during the civil war, where al-Assad is accused of having committed war crimes by UN spokespersons, though no formal charges have been brought. For several years, Russia and Israel have maintained a special hotline to prevent air forces from clashing in the skies over Syria. Israel alone has carried out about 200 bombing campaigns in Syria in the last 2 years. Israel illegally annexed the Golan Heights in 1981 after it conquered and illegally occupied the region from Syria in the 1967 war. Its actions in Syria today are in part to protect its illegal decades-long occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights. This has been the Middle East Minute Plus, a joint production of KPFK and Jewish Voice for Peace.
Last week, Rwandan President Paul Kagame released nearly 2,100 political prisoners. Kagame has been in power since his Rwandan Patriotic Front rebel forces secured the country in 1994, bringing Rwanda's month-long genocide to a close after the deaths of nearly a million people at the hands of their fellow citizens. Most, but not all, of those victims were ethnic Tutsis, and ethnicity still remains a potent fact of political life in the country. One of the most prominent prisoners not released last week is a woman who challenged Kagame in last year's election at the head of the People's Salvation Movement. Diane Rwigara was charged with, quote, inciting insurrection, according to the Washington Post. Kagame went on to win 99% of the vote. Rwigara's trial begins today, even as thousands of recently released prisoners rejoin their families and ponder what to do next. One of those released was another former female presidential candidate, Victoire Ingabire, a Hutu performer who was arrested in 2010 after saying that it was only Tutsis who died in 1994. Anne Garrison, a reporter with KPFA Berkeley, has more.
Victoire Ingabire, a member of Rwanda's Hutu ethnic majority, had been in prison for 8 years for terrorism and minimizing the Rwandan genocide after she attempted to run against President Paul Kagame in 2010. Kizito Mihigo, a gospel singer and a member of the Tutsi minority, had been in prison since 2015 for singing in a video recording that all Rwandans, Hutu and Tutsi, had lost loved ones in the 1994 massacres. This is a recording of Victoire Ingabire's voice, which was added to Song for Madame Victoire Ingabire, a song recorded to celebrate her heroism while she was in prison. Let me tell all Rwandans that what we wish for is that all of us should work together to make sure that such a tragedy will never take place again. That is one of the reasons why the political party FDU made a decision to return to the country peacefully without resorting to violence, as many people think that the solution to Rwanda's problems is to resort to armed struggle. We do not believe that shedding blood should resolve problems. When one sheds blood, the blood comes back to haunt him or her. And that was a recording of Victoire Ingabire's voice. President Paul Kagame granted Ingabire executive clemency, which will not allow her to run for office. For that, Kagame would have to convert her executive clemency release to unconditional release. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
Portland comedy icon and good friend of KABU, Aaron Ross, left us earlier this year for the bright lights and noxious air of Los Angeles, or Ross Angeles, as he likes to call it. But he's back in Portland, at least for another few days, for the premiere of his YouTube series, Training Wheels. We welcome Aaron and his writing partner, Jordan Palladino, back to the KABU studios to find out more about the new series and whatever else they've been up to. Aaron and Jordan, thanks for coming into KABU.
Thank you so much, Ken. It's good to be here with the last bastion of truth here in Portland, which is you.
Aaron, you had a very long run in Portland, over 9 years, and what was it, 700 episodes of Who's the Ross? So that was a live onstage talk show at Dante's downtown. Yeah. And about a year ago, you came in because you wrote and performed the one-man theater production Al Gore Memorial High School. Why a web-based TV series? You're like master of all media.
That's a good question. Yeah, that's right. What was my intro title? Portland comedy icon?
Icon, yeah.
Wow, that's incredible.
That's high praise.
That's high praise. And now I'm master of all, the Multnomah master of media.
And I wish you were Supreme Court nominee, but you're not, so.
Oh, my goodness. Well, we'd still say penis otherwise.
Hey, there we go.
This is for the listeners. Ken said, you know, but just before you guys, I had to say penis on the air. And I was like, wow.
What kind of country are we living in? We'll say it again. That's the news, yeah.
Well, in relation to our interview, it'll be.
Anyway, let's get back to Training Wheels.
Yes.
Well, that's just like Training Wheels, the metaphor for the fact that they started wobbling there and we went off track.
We did.
We decided to create Training Wheels, an online sitcom that's now 10 episodes. Jordan Palladino, who's here, my co-writer of Who's the Ross, our late night talk show, because I think it was just like it was the next logical step in, you know, when you want this to be a career and you're an actor and a comedian, you're like, well, I want to write something. I want to create something that is like what I grew up with, like a sitcom. And then the next after that is movie. But we were like, we just felt that was the natural step. It's not always a natural step to play yourself in the sitcom as we do.
What were there any when you mentioned sitcoms that you grew up with? Were there any that kind of influenced Training Wheels?
Seinfeld
is probably, it's the greatest sitcom of all time.
I agree. It's the funniest.
It's just the baseline, I think, and especially when you're 10 or 12 when it's airing, you're soaking that up. Like
and it's still on.
And it's still on.
And it's still funny.
And it is still funny.
Oh, I agree. Oh, well, let's tell the listeners a little bit about the premise of Training Wheels. You mentioned you play yourself.
Yes.
And it's based on Jordan's experience on Who's the Ross here in Portland.
Yeah, so for a decade, we created a late-night talk show in the city. It's a pretty big goal, you know, that we sort of shot for the moon, but back down on Earth, you know, we weren't very good at dealing with real adult life. So we always say that the show's about two buddies who are good at dreaming but bad at reality.
I'm very good at producing Who's the Ross, but bad
sure,
at kind of what goes on outside.
You know, talk show, but not pay our rent.
Yeah, or get a real job, whatever that means.
You know, or move out of mom's house, whatever that means.
Yeah, or maintain a relationship.
Yeah, or learn how to ride a bike, which is...
These
yeah.
are all episodes yeah. in the season.
And true
and
things,
true
like Jordan
things,
still
yeah.
doesn't know how to ride a bicycle.
Yeah, I'd fall over. If you put a bike in front of me right now, you'd have a lawsuit on your hands.
What about one of those new scooters? Have you tried that?
Double lawsuit.
Yeah, double lawsuit. There's no way he could do that.
No, no chance.
Now, the 10-episode season of Training Wheels debuts next Sunday, September 30th. Mm-hmm. And starting Sunday, viewers can see a new episode every Sunday for 10 weeks. Jordan, yeah. what can we expect? And I think you just mentioned a few of those episodes.
yeah.
Learning to ride a bike and a few
yeah.
other.
There's a lot of wild stuff. There's me learning how to ride a bike, Aaron judging a... adult beauty contest, we'll say.
Sure.
Me making a adult video. A lot of adult stuff here, really.
Yeah, I think it's just like, it's sort of just the follies, these sort of millennial follies that are kind of relatable to people, you know. The like, you know, you think you'd be able to accomplish these life things at this age, and we all stumble with that. So you know, you see a lot of dealing with relationship or the kind of the ideas like, do I get a real job, and does that get in the way, and if it doesn't get in the way, will I actually last more than one day at that real job?
Yeah, or like if my rent, which I don't pay because I live with my parents
still,
but when the rent goes up, what are you supposed to do?
Right.
How do you work around that? How do you, you know, do you want, you can't just give up everything you've built.
Right. And that is actually a real Portland problem.
Actually, very common problem
yes.
in Portland now with the rents rising. Speaking of Portland, mm-hmm. The show is filmed right here in Portland, or most of it. I know there was a little filmed
yeah.
in Seattle.
yeah. yeah, we went up to Seattle where someone on the freeway, when we tried to film an establishing shot, tried to beat us up. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah, that'll be on the outtake.
Yeah,
that I've got to see.
Yeah.
Was it difficult getting the necessary talent for the show, finding guest stars, getting permission to film on location here without getting beat up?
No, we didn't ask for permission. Portland has an incredible wealth of talent. So we've got so many wonderful actors on the program from Portland, including Darius Pierce, who's one of the greatest theater actors in town.
Greg James
on the program.
Rachel Lynn Meyer.
Rachel
does
Lynn
a great job. She plays your girlfriend on the show. Or?
That's right. A friend of mine from growing up. she plays my roommate.
The other Rachel Meyer plays your girlfriend.
There's another Rachel Meyer that plays my girlfriend. There are a lot of Rachels in the show.
There's Rachel Lynn Meyer and a Rachel Meyer.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And other Rachels. It's very confusing.
It's
when you see the show, you'll see that there are lots of Rachels in our lives. And you know, I've got a big shout out to the music that we've had in the show. I love the Portland music scene, but the musical cameos we've had on the show.
Yeah, we've had Boone Howard, we've had Nathan Baumgartner from And.
Rashid Jamal.
We had Berg from And.
Chris Funk of the Decemberists, Sunday Trey of the Far Side.
Guitar player Dave Dahl of Dave's Killer Bread.
That's right.
Yeah,
Dave
Dahl's
in the finale episode too. And we built up a lot of goodwill over a decade doing our program here, doing Who's the Ross.
You know,
doing
almost everybody in town from that show.
I do.
Weathermen, nice. Mayors have been on the show.
This is true.
Basketball players, athletes, politicians.
Yep. Local
just
nut
amazing.
Jobs. Yeah. But my favorite person is you, Ken.
Of course.
Because you asked the good questions.
You do ask the good questions.
And from someone that asked the bad questions, thank you.
So I was wondering, Jordan, we'll start with you.
Okay.
I think Aaron might continue with the answer. What's the process for writing, filming, and editing the episodes? I know you and Aaron collaborate, at least on the writing part.
Yeah.
And you act together in the series, of course.
Well, there'd be ideas that we had that would be, you know, silly, goofy things. Or a lot of it just would come from natural conversations. Like, what's the best way to make someone feel good? Kind of thing. And, you know, in a romantic sense, And so Aaron was giving me some tips or advice, and I was like, oh, man, I had no idea what I was doing. And he's like, yeah, well, see, I'm here to teach you this kind of stuff. And so, like, that
I taught Jordan
be...
to be a great lover, and what he's getting at is that's in the
that's
second
in an
episode.
Yeah. But a lot of it, my favorite things were things that just happened in real life that we then decided to pretty much take exactly what happened and translate it to film.
And Aaron, we have a little time left, about
yes.
a minute or so. Can you give us a few impressions of life in Los Angeles now versus Portland? And
yeah, here, I'll give you an impression of life in Los Angeles. It sounds like this. And then also there's lots of horn sounds.
They honk a lot
screaming.
There.
Screaming. Just see Michael Douglas in Falling Down.
But you've revived Who's the Ross there. It's,
well, it wasn't dead, so I took it down
but
there.
But it just moved.
Who's the Ross, we play in Los Angeles monthly at Molly Malone's. The show's been going great, and the guests we've been getting have been outstanding. We had one of the actors from Reno 911 on. And hip-hop artists Jurassic 5 and The Far Side, people from Nickelodeon that have done shows like Guts, and these people that I grew up watching and idolizing have been on, enjoyed the show, and then they're like my friends now, and that's a weird experience and very exciting. They sort of co-sign the work, and they believe in me, and it feels really good. So,
and we believe in you here in KBOO.
Thank you, Ken. Ken, I want to use. Ken, that was too good.
Yeah.
I want to use the last couple seconds to just tell people you want to find the show. You go to trainingwheelsshow.com. Please subscribe so you can get updates when each new episode comes out. It starts September 30th, but every Sunday you'll get a brand new episode. There are 10 of them. We're really proud of the work we did.
Very
so go to
proud.
trainingwheelsshow.com, subscribe, check the episodes out. If you go right now, you get a sneak peek of the pilot. We actually have it up if you look for it. So
trainingwheelsshow.com.
Good work, buddy.
Well, Aaron Ross, Jordan Palladino, thanks again for coming into KBOO and Mazel Tov on the new series. We've been talking live in the KBOO studios with Aaron Ross and Jordan Palladino, creators and actors in the new YouTube TV series Training Wheels, which debuts this Sunday, September 30th. For more information on the show, as mentioned, go to trainingwheelsshow.com. This is Ken Jones for KBOO News.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 24th, 2018. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Lucas Campbell, Yasmin Kobanoglu, Ken Jones, Layla Kanan, and Janka Soderberg. The producer is Kyle Carezzi, and our engineer is Mike Patoklis. The interim directors of Evening News and Public Affairs are Sam Bauman and Teresa Mitchell. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Summer Barraza.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up Tuesday morning on KBOO at 7 is Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, the Abe and Joe Talk radio show covers politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist with a liberal dose of listener calls. At 9, on alternative radio, academic and economist Yanis Fadou-Fakis talks about how capitalism really works, a far cry from what's taught in economics classes. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio features two new works, The Wolf at Shaking the Tree Theater and Cop Out Beyond Black, White, and Blue at the August Wilson Red Door Project. At 11, Art Focus talks to curators from the newly opened Carnation Contemporary Gallery in North Portland. And be sure to tune into KBOO tonight at 11 o'clock. For the Holy Crowley Hour, our guests are Rob Harrison and Paul Chetty of the Gamma Radio podcast from Wales and Aaron Parecki of the Minute Pulp Romance podcast. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on that donate button. Good night, Summer. Good night, Mike.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
on the 27th of October is the first annual Portland Psychedelic Conference. And could you tell me a little bit about where that's going to be, what people can expect if they attend?
Of course. It's going to be here in Portland, Oregon at the Alberta Abbey. And we're going to have a lineup of speakers, PhDs, people specialized in naturopaths and healing medicines and such. And our keynote speaker is Dennis McKenna, who is among the leading visionaries pretty much in this whole field. So we are offering continued education credits to mental health care professionals, and we're also working on continuing education for naturopaths. But that one we won't know the answer to until October 8th.
Thank you, Jason. So we are also joined today by a couple of the speakers who will be at the conference, Dr. Erica Zelfand.
Hello.
And Dr. Alyssa Bazinet.
Hello.
Dr. Bazinet, you will be speaking about the potential use of MDMA in the treatment of PTSD?
Yes, that's correct. So there is currently a research study that's being conducted through the Multidisciplinary Association on Psychedelic Studies. They are in phase three of a FDA clinical trial to approve MDMA as a medication used in as an adjunct to psychotherapy in treating post-traumatic stress disorder. So I'll be speaking on the current research that's been done so far and what the future looks like for therapists who are interested in using this intervention with their patients with post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay, and just sort of a thumbnail sketch, what does that future look like if it is approved by the FDA?
So mental health professionals who are licensed are able to undergo training currently through the Multidisciplinary Association on Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS as they're commonly known, to go through and learn how to do the therapy. You would need to have a medical provider who can carry a Schedule I license to actually prescribe the MDMA. But the therapist would be using that in a psychotherapy protocol with clients in their practices.
I'm not exactly sure how to phrase this, but would this be a particularly big break with accepted treatments for PTSD?
Yes, absolutely. The data is looking that way so far. So the effect sizes on the published studies that have been completed are much larger than the traditionally accepted therapies for post-traumatic stress disorder that currently exist. I do want to be careful in noting that many of the treatments that have been developed are certainly effective for a significant portion of people who are diagnosed with PTSD, but there is room for improvement. So for a lot of people, they are not getting better, or we're just not able to kind of offer a long enough time period working with them. So this is definitely a unique and different intervention.
If I can piggyback on that, I'll also mention that the clinical trials are specifically on patients that have treatment-resistant post-traumatic stress disorder, meaning that they have tried other therapies that have not, for one reason or another, worked for them. And that one out of every three military deaths is due to suicide. So this is an issue that has captured the attention of many mental health care providers, as well as the military is quite invested in seeing novel breakthrough therapies that can help with post-traumatic stress disorder.
So Dr. Zelfand, before we get into like what a session like that might actually look like, I was wondering, could you tell us a little about the history of the psychedelic sciences?
Sure. Well, the history is long and juicy and interesting, and there actually was a rather rich, what was beginning to become a whole field here of psychedelic healing, and there was a big halt that happened on that research due to changes in drug law and policy in the United States, and we went through this period of dark ages where all of the work went underground. It didn't stop necessarily, it just got quiet, and studies weren't being published, and the people that were doing this work were doing so really risking their own safety, their own medical licenses if they had them. And now we're having this renaissance of psychedelic healing, where we are actually once again having clinical trials happening above board, and we're able to revisit some of these old studies and reproduce them or create new studies now demonstrating their efficacy. And the first person to win FDA approval since the 1960s was Charles Grob, and he did a pilot study on psilocybin in the treatment of depression and anxiety in cancer patients. And his trial was followed by larger randomized double-blind crossover phase two trials. These were done at Johns Hopkins and NYU in 2016. And these were the kind of big studies that got picked up by a lot of media in patients that had a terminal or life-threatening diagnosis such as cancer and a concurrent depression or anxiety diagnosis. Those patients were treated with psilocybin, which is the active constituent of magic mushrooms, as it's called on the street. And that really, there were other studies that happened, but the scientific rigor of those studies, the large scale of the studies, and just to be frank, the fancy names of the universities associated with those studies were really what started catching the attention of people that were interested in this work, and quite frankly, people that weren't. And now we're having a total psychedelic renaissance, in large part thanks to the Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, which is funding a lot of this work.
Okay. And what's the state of the legality of any of this treatment?
So as of this moment, none of this work, none of these medicines are legal, to the best of my knowledge, outside of the context of a FDA-approved clinical trial.
Okay.
So that being said, those are happening. So we are having FDA-approved clinical trials involving these medicines. Hopefully, these medicines will prove to be as efficacious as we believe that they are. And over time, that will lead to the rescheduling of these medicines. So they will be moved from Schedule 1. FDA Schedule 1 means that a drug has no approved use with no medical value. So hopefully, these substances will get rescheduled, and from there, they will be able to be prescribed accordingly. We're really hoping this is going to go a lot differently than marijuana has, which has been legalized by some states but still remains on the federal Schedule 1, along with heroin. I'll save my comments and opinions about that. Mm-hmm. But hopefully this is going to have a different trajectory.
So an actual treatment session, I'm guessing that depending on the what's being treated and the particular substance that is being used, that it would be different from situation to situation. What would a actual treatment session look like using, for example, MDMA?
Yeah, so you're right that it would depend on, you know, what the indication is that we're treating. So with post-traumatic stress disorder, there are actually three separate types of sessions that would take place in using this particular protocol. So the first would just be preparatory sessions, so meeting with the client, telling them what to expect from the substance, what to expect from what might come up for them emotionally, and just kind of working through the logistics of how that will go so they know what to expect when they're given the substance. And then the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session itself. So it's an 8-hour long session. Typically, there are two therapists that are involved in treating the person. And so they take the substance and are, you know, engaged in psychotherapy for 8 hours straight with this therapy dyad. And then afterwards, there is what's called integration sessions. So that's where a lot of work is done to process what came up during the MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session and work with the material that's arising as a result of that.
And can you talk a little bit about that term, integration, a little bit more? What does that mean in this context?
Yeah, so integration is essentially taking the material, emotional material that came up during the session with the MDMA, and working with that to help the person figure out what that means for their life. So often really intense emotion arises that they may have not been in touch with previously, and so techniques are worked with them to figure out, you know, how to handle that emotion, how to develop coping skills, how to integrate that into their daily lives
just so
and improve their functioning. So it's just an opportunity to work with that material more deeply. Oftentimes when the person is in an altered state, when they're given the MDMA, things come up that they may not immediately remember without some active processing, because their cognition is such that it's not operating as it would, you know, at their normal baseline without being in an altered state. Okay. And so they're working with that material to kind of solidify it for themselves as they go about their daily lives.
And that touches on something that you'll be speaking about, Dr. Zelfand, the balance between that mystical experience aspect of it and the medical treatment aspect of it, and how those reconcile.
Yes, absolutely. With psychedelic research, what they found is that giving people acid or mushrooms and then putting them in a sterile room in a clinic with fluorescent lights and no windows didn't really yield very good outcomes. That is really where the importance of set and setting comes in with this medicine. The setting that the person is actually in when they take the medication, as well as the mind frame that they are in. The way that that translates here with psychedelics is it really speaks to the fact that, yes, these substances work very powerfully on altering brain chemistry. They directly affect neurotransmitter receptor sites, and we know this. In fact, there was one study, which I just would have loved to have been a fly on the wall for this study, done by neuropsychopharmacologist Robin Carhart-Harris, through the Beckley Imperial Research Program in 2016, where they actually did put a bunch of people in fMRI machines, and they did brain scans on them, and then they pulled them out of the machines, and then they gave them all a hit of acid or LSD. And during their sometime in the 6 hours in which they were tripping, they put them back in the machines and redid their brain scans. And what they just the sort of baseline and the before and after photos, I really would advise folks listening to look these up, because they are just phenomenal, the difference between the brain scans. But what they found is that we have this objective data that shows different parts of the brain are suddenly able to communicate in ways that they weren't able to before, and that's called crosstalk. And there's also decreased activity in the region of the brain called the default mode network. And that's a region of the brain that's always humming in the background with this just whatever your background story is, like I'm a loser, or nobody likes me, or things you're worried about. And it's thought that people with depression, anxiety, mental illness have hyperactive default mode network activity. So we have these beautiful images showing, quite frankly, that that's getting turned down, and crosstalk is happening, and we know that, you know, these receptor sites get activated, and I'll talk about the details of that next month at the conference. But what we also have are other studies showing that it doesn't matter. I'm just going to use casual talk here because it's just going to make more sense. It doesn't matter how hard somebody trips when they are on a psychedelic substance. Whether they have a intense trip or a very mild trip doesn't so much influence the therapeutic outcome of the medicine. What does seem to influence the success, however, is whether or not they have a mystical experience while they were under the effects of the medicine. And one example of this is there was a smoking cessation study which showed that when people were on psilocybin, if they had a profound spiritual experience, they were more likely to successfully quit smoking and be smoke-free at 12-month follow-up, regardless of if they, quote-unquote, tripped hard. And actually, one of the researchers behind that study, Albert Garcia Ramu, is also going to be speaking at the conference next month as well.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO News in Depth. My name is Sam Bowman, and I was talking today with two of the speakers at the upcoming Portland Psychedelic Conference, the first annual Portland Psychedelic Conference, which will be happening at the Alberta Abbey on October 27th. We were joined in the studio by Jason Harris, the communications director with the Portland Psychedelic Society, Dr. Alyssa Bazinet, a licensed clinical psychologist, and Dr. Erica Zelfand, a naturopathic physician. The doctors will both be speaking at the upcoming conference. And you can find out more about the conference at portlandpsychedelicsociety.org. And you can also go to kboo.fm to hear a longer version of this interview. We just listened to about half of it. There is a lot more interesting stuff to hear. So go to kboo.fm KBOO.org/eveningnews. KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at PCC Cascade in Portland. Kathy will speak on Afghanistan, Iraq, and Yemen, finding hope in countries devastated by U.S. policy. Her particular focus helps expose the direct impacts of U.S. policies, including sanctions, war, drones, and military support for warring parties. Again, that's Kathy Kelly, co-founder of Voices for Creative Nonviolence, on Thursday, September 27th at 7 p.m. at Moriarty Arts Building Auditorium at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. The time is 5:59 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Labor Radio.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to the September 24th edition of Labor Radio, of the working class, for the working class, by the working class. I'm Amanda Hill, here with my co-host Jamie Partridge.
Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Jamie. This evening, we have with us Adrian Inghouse, president of the Oregon Federation of Nurses and Health Professionals. Welcome, Adrian.
Hi, thank you.
We're also going to have with us a little later in the program, Lewis Brennan, an activist and bargaining team member with the Burgerville Workers Union.
Not here quite yet.
Not here quite yet, but we're expecting him soon. So, Adrian, your union, which happens to be my union also, has been in negotiations with one of your employers, Kaiser Permanente, for the past several months. Would you share with our listeners the tone of those talks?
Well, they're very different than they have been in the past. They have been much more traditional. I mean, to back up, Kaiser's part of a... we've been part of a labor management partnership with Kaiser for a long time. We've been involved in a coalition, which recently changed to an alliance with different unions. But at the end of the day, those conversations have always been done not in a traditional manner. And so this time they were very traditional, and we got a lot of pushback. We were miles apart. And just the traditional